We're going to be talking this week, first of all, about the obligations of elders to the congregation, secondly, about the obligation of the congregation to elders, thirdly, about the work and the responsibilities of deacons, and fourthly, I hope if we can possibly get to it, the qualities and characteristics of elders' wives. That would be best and would work most harmoniously if the husband has that office. I have organized my notes in such a way that I think you will be able to follow me, and I will tell you whether I'm on main point number one or what, A, B, or C, as I approach it. So we'll begin with that in mind, and we'll hope for the best. Why would anyone want to be an elder? Let me give you three reasons just in the offing, just something to think about. We know that when we look around and see a need, some of us get a little restless. We'd like to do something about it. And I think this is often the reason that people become interested in the office of the eldership. They see certain weaknesses, they see certain things that really need some attention. And they feel that they can give that attention, so they begin thinking positively. Secondarily, I believe sometimes also, we have enough self-confidence to believe we can make a difference. We believe that perhaps by applying our best sense, our best efforts, that we really can help. And if we are committed to that in the sense that we truly believe we can and have the determination, I think that is another reason. But perhaps the greatest reason of all that any of us would do anything in the church is simply because we can, therefore we must. I believe from the teaching of the scriptures, from the parable of the talents, other teaching that Jesus and the apostles did, that it's incumbent upon each of us, if we are able to do something, then we had better do it. And I remember Paul spoke to the Corinthians. He said, necessity is laid upon me, and it is woe unto me if I preach not the gospel. In other words, because I have the talent, I have the ability, I have the determination, I have the spirit, I have the mind, therefore I must do this. And he said, if I do this willingly, gladly and happily I have a reward. But if it's against my will, then I'm just doing a tiresome job and I'll get no reward for this. And I think whenever we're serving God, whenever we're trying to do our best, we keep that strongly in mind. Because I can, therefore I must. I believe that the obligations of an elder to a congregation should always be headed with this first point. He must set an example. And I will have 6 points under this, A through F. This is point number one. According to 1 Peter 5:3, he must set that example. Lest anyone think that strange, remember that according to Philippians 3:17, the apostles had to set an example. Evangelists, according to 1 Timothy 4, verse 12, must set examples. Even Jesus had to set an example, 1 Peter 2:21. Remember, too, that the older women are to set examples for the younger, and the older men to be examples for the younger. So from top to bottom, incidentally, we all set examples. So it isn't at all strange that the elder would do this. Now, the specific areas that I believe his example should be most prevalent in are these. A, in effort. That is, consistent, hard work. And I think an elder must heed, perhaps more strongly than anyone, perhaps, the admonition in Galatians 6, verse 9, never to grow weary in doing well. We have the same admonition in 2 Thessalonians 3:13. Simply do not be weary in doing good. Now, I know that there are a lot of hours that elders work behind the scenes, weekends, sometimes far into the night sometimes. It is difficult not to get weary. I don't think this has to do with physical fatigue, but rather with mental weariness. Tired minds, tired will, tired indetermination, and the consistent hard work that he must put forth, I know is difficult to maintain. I've always been very sympathetic sometimes with the hard work that elders do, because I know sometimes they seem to receive very little appreciation for it. Point B, an elder, according to 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, must be temperate. In Titus 1, verse 8, that's called self-control. Same thing. Now, we've talked enough about that I probably don't need to explain this, but we simply mean that he has his emotions in check, that even in stressful situations, he can remain calm. So the evenness of temperament, that temperate and self-control imply is very essential for an elder. Point C, he must be able to teach effectively. Now, these things that we already know, I'm going over quickly in case you wonder why I'm moving along like this. According to Acts 20, verse 28, 1 Peter 5, 2, he must be an effective teacher. Now, this doesn't mean only that he has a grasp of the Scriptures. It means that he also understands techniques of teaching, how to approach certain things. For example, biographical material can be taught differently than doctrinal material. Material that is highly symbolic in nature needs to be handled somewhat differently from either of these two kinds. Sometimes our teaching should be highly analytic. Sometimes it should be more or less chronological. Sometimes it ought to be, shall we say, just grouping things together to get an overview or a good idea, perhaps, of a list of happenings. So depending on the material, depending on how we should approach it, the elder must be skilled not only in the information, but also in the methods, in the techniques of presenting. Now, his lifestyle, of course, must be above reproach. This is called good behavior, and I think that covers it quite well, 1 Timothy 3, verse 2. Because we will get into this in other areas, I'm going to go right ahead. Point E is faithfulness. And this, to me, means that the church comes first with the elder. I think this is an absolute essential, because even though he has a home life like everyone else, even though many times he has a full-time job, he still must put the church first. Now, if he isn't willing to do that, he should not have the position, because sometimes we have situations that absolutely must be dealt with, and they must be dealt with now. They cannot wait for a month. They can't wait for a year. And if he has to forego an activity with his family, if he has to forego some rest or something he's planned, so be it. The church must come first. Remember that he must give account to God for the work he does in the church. Therefore, he must be responsible to God before anyone else. The church must come first. He also has to be an example, point F, in maturity. The maturity of an elder must be evident at all times. And this must be evident in two ways. First, he is required to be physically mature. He isn't to be a novice. He has to be an older person. This is what the term elder implies. Presbyter and other terms refer to other things, but elder refers to age primarily. He has to have age and experience. He has to be a settled person who has had experience with many of the different vicissitudes and difficulties in life. So he has to have a point of view that has been tempered by the crucible of life, so that he can understand the problems of other people. That maturity also has to be spiritual. That means that he's a grown man scripturally. It means that he has gone on beyond, as we're told in Hebrews 6, verse 1, he has gone far beyond the doctrine of baptisms, the doctrine of faith and confession and these things, and he has advanced high up the ladder of understanding and knowledge of God. And this is absolutely necessary because in dealing with the problems that come about in congregations, without a great knowledge of the Scriptures, there will be situations in which he won't know what to do. But a thorough knowledge of the Scriptures will equip us to deal with almost any kind of family or social problem. I firmly believe with all my heart that we have everything we need to know to deal with any situation in the Scriptures if we understand them well enough. So I think it to be absolutely essential that an elder be mature in knowledge and understanding. He must truly be a man in that area. Point number two, he must inspire confidence. You must look at him and see capability. You must look at him and see dependability. You look at this man and you see someone who can take charge, who is not weak-kneed, afraid, indecisive, who can think quickly and act quickly. Because this kind of person makes you feel good about the church that he administers. Now, this does not mean that a person cannot be meek and humble. Doesn't mean this at all. Because one of the finest elders I have ever known was the meekest man I've ever known. Everything he did was in a very quiet, unassuming way. You would say he was a very low-key individual, but nonetheless, he was tremendously effective. And therefore, an elder doesn't have to be loud. He can be very quiet and still be a tower of strength. I believe the points to be considered that are primary in inspiring confidence are, first of all, A, he must show good judgment. Now, if you see that he has sound judgment and that he has applied this in a number of situations, you feel pretty good about that because you think that will be extended probably most of the time. This doesn't mean that his judgment will always be correct. There aren't any perfect people, there aren't any perfect elders. But it means that the vast majority of the time you can depend on his judgment. Now, judgment is developed through experience. And I don't know that it can be developed any other way. We have to have lived a while. We have to have seen a lot of things. We have to have been involved in a lot of things before we develop good judgment. We also have to have experienced some trial and error in our own lives. It's necessary that we have failed a few times because this improves our judgment. We learn what won't work. We learn what not to do just as effectively as we learn what to do and what will work. His judgment, I think, is most evident in human relationship problems. If he has to counsel a husband or wife, judgment is critical here. If he has to talk with young people pertaining to a situation, judgment is absolutely essential. If he makes, for example, some plans for the congregation, looking ahead, many things must be taken into account. He cannot be impulsive, making rash decisions. No, his good judgment must color at all times his activities and his words. B, he must be fair-minded. This is a critically important thing, fair-mindedness. This means that he can look at a situation objectively. He can see both sides. And this means that he can't be a bigoted person with a number of hang-ups because these will get in his way. These will block good thinking. These will block good decisions. And these will prejudice the mind. He can't be swayed, for example, by something that happened 20 years ago between him and another person. He can't hold a grudge, because this will get in the way of being fair-minded. He can't be an overly suspicious person, in other words, a non-trusting person who always looks for the worst in people, because if so, he will prejudge. Again, he will not be fair-minded. He has to be an individual who approaches a situation calmly, looks at all of the particulars, and on the basis of those, not emotion, not how well he does or doesn't like someone, but on the basis of what's in the situation, he makes a decision. And if he makes it that way, it will generally be fair. I believe a fair-minded person is probably, if you young people are going with a boy or a girl who isn't a Christian, if you think this is a good person, I think there are two tests you should apply. First, is that a fair-minded person? Second, is that a logical person? A logical person, when shown clear proof, will accept an idea. An illogical person won't. A fair-minded person, when shown sufficient evidence, will change his mind. Closed-minded people won't. So if you can find a young man or a girl who is logically oriented and who is fair-minded, you have an excellent opportunity of converting that person. Well, no charge for that. Let me go ahead to point C, courageous. I have had experience, unfortunately, in my life with a number of backboneless elders who, when a critical situation arose, ran. They resigned. I won't mention names or congregations, but let me describe the situations that caused this running. Have any of you read a book by John Updike called Rabbit Run? It's a very interesting book, because the protagonist in this book was an individual who, when he faced a serious problem, instead of dealing with it, would run. He was an outstanding athlete. He had several good characteristics, but this was his one salient weakness. Problems simply scared him to death. He and his wife had a little trouble, so he left her. His boss threatened him for poor workmanship, so he quit. And so his whole life was patterned this way. John Galsworthy wrote a book about flotsam and jetsam. And flotsam and jetsam were like a leaf and a chip just floating on the river. Wherever the river took them, that's where they went. They just floated through life with no plan and no direction. There are various reasons that people are not strong, various reasons that perhaps they don't have the strength of their commitments. I don't know why, but let me just describe two or three situations to give you an idea. In the one case, it was a group of disciplinary actions that needed to be taken on delinquent members. And this man just simply didn't have the courage to go to those people and tell them what had to be said. So he resigned. He ran. He used the excuse that he wasn't patient any longer. He'd lost his patience. That was an excuse. He was afraid, and it was obvious. Another individual I'll describe in the eldership didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings. He was afraid that if he made a strong decision or took a firm stand, that he would tread on people's tender feelings. And therefore, when a situation arose where a number of people had hurt feelings because of a disagreement in the congregation over something they wanted to do, well, it was nothing more than which preacher they would have for a meeting. And they got into a little bit of a squabble. You know, people have favorite preachers for different reasons. I don't think we judge them always on the soundness or the effectiveness of their teaching. I'm afraid sometimes we judge them on personality. How nice they have been when we've had them in our homes and various other things. How easily they laugh. And whether they smile a lot. And how stern they are in some of their teachings. How strongly they uphold the Scripture. Various things. Some of us like very mild people who wouldn't ever offend anyone. Some of us like people who stir us up. Some of us like people who scare us to death. But there are various reasons. At any rate, they debated this for a while and couldn't come to a decision. And so some tender feelings were exposed. And he felt that he just didn't want to tread on those, although he knew very well which of their choices would be best for the congregation. He knew that all the time, because there are certain preachers who are better for a congregation perhaps than another at a given time, in a given situation, depending on the atmosphere and what's going on in the church at that point. And some people are very good, for example, for that, and some would not be so good. Some wouldn't help it at all. But he ran because he just couldn't make a decision. I'll give you one more example, then I'll leave this. This man had some very strong prejudices based on family. This happened years ago, and I was right in the middle of this, and I got my tender little feelings hurt, but I survived just fine. But this man didn't believe that anyone should participate in the church unless they were somehow related to him. Now, he didn't say that in so many words, but his actions, his talk, berated him, as Jesus would say. I asked him on one occasion if I could participate. I was old enough. I was capable. I felt I could. I asked him if I could participate. I said, I would be glad to read. I would be happy to offer prayer. Anything you'd like me to do, I'll be glad to pass the emblems. I wasn't particular. I just wanted to do something. I wanted to participate. He told me, go get 3 years of experience, then come back and we'll use you. Strong family orientation. See, you're not part of the group unless you're part of the family. I hate to run into an eldership that has hang-ups like this because they are detrimental to the church. They stifle the initiative of many of the members. And this man made the mistake of trying to make church workers out of people who couldn't be. And therefore, he caused the church to suffer a great deal, right along with the suffering person up front who shouldn't have been there, who didn't have the capability to be there, nor the inclination of mind, I might add. And it was a very, very bad situation. Well, we'll leave that there. But what I'm saying is this, that if elders don't have the courage to look outside their own families, if they don't have the courage to stand up in tough situations, if they don't have the courage to make decisions, they're of very little use to a congregation. They just can't help a congregation much if they don't have that stiff upper lip and that strong backbone. Those are absolutely essential. We're told in Romans 12, verse 8, that he who leads must do so with diligence. That means without hesitation, without procrastination, but he must get to it quickly and do it well, with diligence. Because sin cannot be allowed to remain in the church. If an elder doesn't deal with the situation quickly, it can lead to something like this. I was talking to an elder. Well, I talked to him for 3 days and three nights almost. It seemed like we talked almost nonstop. He had allowed three families in the congregation to get by without the corrective discipline that was needed. And when a fourth arose, he was reluctant to take action because he said, well, if I do something about this, then I'll have to do something about those. That's what he should have done, even though he was tardy, even though he was 5 years late in dealing with situations that should have been dealt with. He wouldn't deal with the current one because of those in the background. Well, if you are blocked from an action because of past mistakes, then again, you're not going to be of much use to a congregation if you're an elder. There just isn't any substitute for courage. Now, incidentally, this is a quantity that evangelists must have in high amounts also. They have to have a lot of courage. And it won't hurt the individual member to have a good deal of this too. So what I'm saying is, this isn't only a commodity that the elder needs. We all need this. But since he so particularly needs it in so many situations, I think it appropriate to elaborate on it here. Now, I have covered 2 points. He must set an example, and he must inspire confidence. Let me cover one more point with you, number three, then I'll stop and ask for questions or comments. Point number three, he must be a strong leader. He has to have leadership ability that is a cut above the average. In order to be a good leader, A, you must have the knack of enlisting people to help. Now, in case you don't understand what I mean by this, I'll explain. Some people know exactly how to ask other people, and they respond positively every time, nearly. Others ask and get no help. Now, I have a stellar example of a person who has a wonderful ability in this area. That's my wife. I've watched her operate many times. She can walk into a situation where women are milling around. Maybe they're working on a float. And they're just milling around, not getting very much done. And she will walk in and just say, Mary, would you do this, please? And Jeanette, if you'd do that. And her tone of voice and her manner, and she's got them all working just like bees within a few minutes. This is a talent that people have. Wonderful talent that people have. Now, I believe this can be developed to a considerable degree. I believe we can learn to improve ourselves and our chances immensely when we approach people. But there are various things that we might say to people when we approach them. If you just say, kind of smilingly, I need a good horse, I've got a load to pull. Any little thing that kind of breaks the ice, that lets them know that you need them, but you're not going to force them to do it. You're not going to be cross about it. This isn't one of those punishment assignments. This is something you'd like them to do, and you're going to be nice about it, and you're going to ask. You're not going to tell. You're going to ask. And I think if a person works on this, that this becomes almost second nature after a while. But this is absolutely essential. An elder can't do everything by himself. This is impossible. He has to have much assistance. And he has to ask for it sometimes, because we don't all volunteer, do we? Sometimes we have to be coaxed a little. So he has to have that knack. We have to respond well when he asks us. B, he has to know how to delegate responsibility and the authority to carry it out. because responsibility without the authority to finish the job is useless. So he must delegate both. This doesn't have to be a deacon, although many times he will delegate responsibility and authority to do it to a deacon, but it doesn't have to be. It could be any member of the congregation. For example, if we need some work on a furnace, an air conditioner, and one of the members has two or three friends who work in this area, delegate that person with both the authority and the responsibility to get some bids, to get all the specs that the church needs to consider, to investigate the situation, and just let him do this himself because he knows some people and they know other people. And in the process of time between one business meeting and the next, he can have checked with a half a dozen in an area like this, perhaps 8 or 10 different people who work in that area. And if he has done a good job of describing exactly what the job is, they will have all the specifications and the bid in black and white for him to bring back to the congregation. And jobs like that can be delegated to people very easily, very conveniently, and generally speaking, they will be done with dispatch and done well. An elder must not be afraid to delegate responsibility and authority to carry through with it. Must not be afraid of that. I think this develops a trust in the congregation if an elder does this effectively. The members feel that elders depend on them and trust them to do things well. And congregational members respond well when they have this feeling. They also feel needed. It's important to make members of the church feel important to the institution, that they're really a part of it. And a job like this sometimes can be assigned to a person who is a little borderline, perhaps, in his affections for the Lord. Because if you can get him involved in something he can do well, it just might make a big difference in how he feels about this body. I think very often a person with not very much interest can be inspired somewhat by being given a task to do that that person can accomplish and trusted to do it. This is an important part of the elder's knowledge of people and understanding of people, understanding of the congregation, and he should look for persons who need this kind of an assignment, something that they can do, something that will be very good for them as well as for the church. C, at critical times, he must not be afraid. Now, I spoke of courage a moment ago. There are many people who have courage overall, but who sometimes need a little while to marshal it. I mean by that their first reaction may be a little shaky, but after a day or two, they have stiffened their resolve and they are considerably stronger. An elder sometimes, in a critical situation, must be strong instantly because it can't wait. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I wasn't too old when this happened, but we had a member of the church who was very abrasive. Well, in a word, he was contentious. And he would do his best with anyone who came in the door that he didn't know to immediately start a quarrel. The elders knew this, and therefore, when they saw him make this attempt, they would immediately step up to this person and the person he was talking to and get the subject changed. They would divert the person. There's some people I'd like you to meet. Various ways they had of dealing with it, but they would immediately cut him off at the pass. They just would not let him continue because they knew what he was going to do. And those were wise elders. But I saw them a number of times. Someone would come in the door, he would make a beeline for them, and they would try to beat him to them. because they just simply didn't want him making a bad impression on them. And when you have a visitor, you don't want to be greeted by an irate person who is willing to take your ear off. You just simply don't want that and don't need that. But he just simply had this chip on his shoulder. He wanted to fight. And someone who didn't know him was always a prime prospect in his mind. So there are times when you need to take immediate action and don't fear to do it. If someone says something in the pulpit, for example, on Sunday morning or during a meeting or at any time, and that is an absolutely false statement, the elder should immediately challenge it. Now, you hear what I said? The elder should immediately challenge it. Don't just let it go by and then talk to the person after church. And I'll tell you why. Why should you let a person develop a teaching the Bible doesn't authorize? When you first hear it, that's the time to cut it off. Not after it's already been expressed, because someone might believe it. You may have some weak members to whom that sounds pretty good. Don't let that person explain it, expound on it. See, this is the logic behind what is said in 3 John. If an individual comes to you, said John, and doesn't bring this doctrine, in other words, the doctrine of Christ in its purity, don't invite the person in your house. Don't even wish him good luck. In other words, send him on down the road. And the reason for that? Very simple. You don't want to give him an opportunity to fully express something false. Tom, wait for the mic, please.
2 John?
Excuse me. 2 John. Thank you. Now, we consider that rather high-handed, don't we? That kind of treatment of an individual. We consider that unfriendly. And very often we bring the enemy right into the camp. Roll out the red carpet and give him every opportunity to spread his pernicious doctrine. Now, it doesn't always happen in the church. Sometimes it happens in the home. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, we had a member who was grossly out of line. He was guilty of immoral conduct and various things. He wasn't in any way repentant. And the congregation knew that some action was going to have to be taken. He also saw it coming. So he asked to meet with the members at one of their houses, and he set out to justify himself. And they let him talk for 2 hours and never challenged him at all. He just snowed them under. And there were people sitting there who had good Bible knowledge who should have spoken up. But they just let him explain his whole rationale. Everything he said was false. Every excuse he used was specious, counterfeit. But they listened. They took it all in, and no one challenged. And I strongly suspect if someone hadn't got hold of them rather quickly, which he did, and shook them up, they'd have let that person continue. It is dangerous to let a congregation of people hear false doctrine simply because of the gullibility of some of the members at times. You see, we don't all know the same amount about the Bible. We're not all sufficiently safeguarded against falsehood. Sometimes something might sound very logical. It might sound as though it's genuine. And if you need another example, simply think back to the time when the church was split about 75-25 by a doctrine that said that everyone who had been baptized for the remission of sins was your brother, no matter where he was or what he was practicing. Now, that had the ring of logic to it, and it nearly destroyed the church because the membership got a thorough hearing of that false doctrine. Now, if the first mention of that from that person, someone had stood up and said, "Brother, I'm sorry. We will not allow falsehood to be taught here for truth." How much trouble could have been caused, averted, in congregation after congregation after congregation. But you see, we may like the person who's telling us something that isn't right. Don't hesitate. Stop it then and there, or you're asking for trouble. I don't think we have a choice about that. And don't worry if the person has his feelings hurt. It's far less important for someone to have hurt feelings than for two or three members to be confused. Let's remember this. D, he must have great patience with weak members. Great patience with weak members. We're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, beginning in verse 22, that the weak members are the more necessary. We're told also that on those weak members, just as on our body, we are to bestow more abundant honor because they are the weaker parts. Therefore, a weak member is a kind of special case, Paul is saying. You give that person a lot of attention. You be very careful how you treat that person. And especially be very patient. Remember what Paul said to the Romans, chapter 14, verse 1. Receive a weak brother, but not to a lot of doubtful accusations. Yes, he may be confused. Maybe he isn't just straight on everything. But you receive that weak brother and don't immediately start faulting him for his weaknesses. Be patient. Be understanding. And the elder must especially possess these qualities. I have one more point in this area, and then I will cease for your comments and questions. I'll go over this quickly. He must have a "we will do it" instead of a "you will do it" mentality. In other words, he says, "Let's do it. We will do it," not "you will do it." And this makes all the difference. All the difference. Because he is to be a hands-on supervisor. Many of you know what that means. In other words, he works with you. He does some of this to give you an example. He isn't afraid, in other words, to do what he asks you to do. And he wouldn't ask you to do what he wouldn't do. So he's a hands-on person. And he believes in the philosophy of "we will do this together." Not only does this suggest a partnership, but it suggests a mutual capability, which also is good for congregations. All right, I will be quiet now and let you talk for a couple of minutes. We don't have much time, but do we have a question quickly here?
In the King James Version, I have the New International here, and I can't seem to find what I want. There is a statement that says plainly, "whose mouths must be stopped." Can you tell me where that's at?
Does someone have a international, a new wording on that? Yes, yes, I know where it is. But I mean, does someone have another wording on it? Anyone?
That...
Well, that's clear enough to me. I don't need another wording.
That's a very pointed verse, and it's not that easy to enforce.
No, it isn't.
But it is at times absolutely necessary.
Thank you. John.
Jim, you commented on false teachers, and then you commented on weak members. Would you handle a false teacher who's deliberately trying to pull people away differently than a weak member who ignorantly taught falsely?
Absolutely, because they are totally different things.